you an email, or if we've asked you once.
Once I've got your, once I've got your email list, I think I'll be fine. So if you don't get it, let me know.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm recording this. I don't know how, where they'll be, but I'm recording each session as well. So yeah, I'm keeping your emails. And so I should remember who I've sent it to that way. Okay. I'm aiming for about an hour. I'm trying to stop at 8 to just respect everybody's time. I don't want to go more than your attention spans and so on. So that's what I'm trying to do. So in Revelation, one of my goals is to make sure that you understand that Revelation is singular, not plural. It's not revelations, it's revelation. Okay, so make sure we've got that. It's revelation. Now, the thing about revelation is that it's often an oxymoron to us, because the idea of revelation, and even as the book begins, it implies that we're supposed to understand it. I mean, revelation means opening, right? It means opening up. And yet, as we read it, we don't understand it. We're not sure what it's supposed to mean. Does anybody know what the word apocalypse means? So now you have to unmute and answer my question. Okay, you can hit the space bar and it unmutes you. You can. What does apocalypse mean, Beth? Are you?
Well, unmuting? I'm already unmuted, aren't I?
Yep.
I associate it with the end of the world.
Yeah, and you do. Now that's actually not the meaning, but that's the association. Who knows actually the meaning of the word? Anybody? If you grew up with the King James Version of the Bible, you actually know. Do you know why I'm saying that? Because if you grew up with the King James Version of the Bible, what's this book of the Bible called? It's called the Apocalypse.
Revelation.
But if you grew up with the King James, it's the Apocalypse of St. John. Okay? Revelation, apocalypse actually means revelation. Apocalypse comes from the Greek, which means open up, revelation. So we use the word apocalypse associated with end times because we all believe that revelation is about the end times. And so we just use that word that way, but it actually doesn't mean that. So now you've learned something already, if you did not know. Apocalypse does not have anything to do with end times in terms of its definition. But the association is understandable. So when we say something, oh, it's the apocalypse, Apocalypse Now, the movie or something, which I never saw, but apocalypse, we say it has to do with end times, but it only means the opening up, okay? It means revealing, revelation, okay? Now, there are the book of Revelation, I'm actually following the notes here. There are three different genres of the book of Revelation. In other words, you know, sometimes, you know, we have the gospels, we have prophets and all that. Revelation, it's three different types of a book. One of them, of course, is that it is prophecy. Okay, John is being told what's going to happen. Okay, now here's where we disagree with lots of different scholars, lots of different people. They're going to happen, but when they're going to happen is what's disagreed upon, right? When John writes it, obviously it's future for him. When Isaiah is given his prophecies, it's future, but is it going to happen next week, next year, thousands of years? So that's even the question in Revelation, okay? It's future, it's a prophetic book, but it's not only prophecy, okay? It's also, okay, they're letters, okay? It's a letter to seven churches. Write this to the seven churches. And so it's an epistle, but it's an unusual epistle, okay? But it really is an epistle. Write this to the seven churches. Say these things. So most of us forget that. We would not normally think of Revelation as an epistle. But it's also apocalyptic. Okay, now I'm using that word again. Because apocalyptic means revealing, right? It doesn't mean end times. And apocalyptic literature is a kind of literature, particularly from the Bible, where we use numbers, symbols, and pictures to tell a story about usually the end times. Okay, so Revelation is apocalyptic literature where we have to interpret the pictures that are seen, the numbers, all that, the horns, the crowns, the seven, the three, the thousand, all these things, the beast, all these things are apocalyptic pictures. Somebody tell me somewhere else in the Bible where apocalyptic pictures and things like that are used.
Daniel?
Yep, Daniel, okay. You've got, and one of the places is actually Nebuchadnezzar's dream, right? He has a dream and he can't interpret it because it's apocalyptic. You know, these four different kingdoms, okay? And then there are several other, many apocalyptic pictures in Daniel, okay? There are other books too, but that's the main one. Okay, now, I'm gonna skip, I'm not skipping at all. Who wrote Revelation? I'm not gonna go into this in great detail. It's generally agreed that it is written by the Apostle John, okay? I am gonna mention that there actually are some evangelical scholars that agree it's John, but it never says it's the Apostle John. So some people actually argue about that. It's not worth arguing, okay? And I don't have time to say how we are pretty sure it's John, that the church fathers affirmed it and all of that, but he never actually says, I am the one that Jesus loved or anything like that. He just says, I, John, which was a very common name, okay? I'm going to make the assumption, and most scholars do agree, it is the Apostle John, okay? But when did he write it? When? That matters, and here's why, okay? If you go to a commentary or study Bible, most of our study Bibles will tell us that he wrote it probably in the 80s or the 90s when he was a very old man, okay? I'm not talking about his age. I'm talking about the very end of the first century, okay? And the reason we say that is because he's writing it to churches who are being persecuted. If you read the letters to the churches, he says, you know, you're persevering and you're being attacked and all that, but you're holding on. So we know the churches are being persecuted. And we look at church history and we say, when were the churches being persecuted? And we know that Emperor Domitian, who was emperor of Rome from 80 to 96, persecuted Christians. We don't have a lot of historical evidence, but we have some. And we know he persecuted Christians for not worshiping him as a god. So that's the most common date that is given. Now, does this matter to you? Most of you probably say, no, I don't care. You know, you tell me when such and such is written and I'm not gonna remember it tomorrow. But here's why it matters, okay? There are a lot of people now, and it's a growing number, that say, no, Revelation was actually written about 30 years earlier than that. Now, if Revelation was written 30 years earlier than that, that means it was written in the 60s. Now, if it was written in the 60s, that means that the temple wasn't destroyed yet. That means that Jerusalem had not yet been sacked by Rome. Now, I don't know if you know your biblical history, but that's an important date we should always know for New Testament. The year 70 is a very important date, okay? So the New Testament, it's all written before the year 70, except for Revelation, people say. But what I'm telling you is a lot of scholars now say, actually, even Revelation is written before the year 70. Who cares, right? Who cares? Well, if it's written before 70, who is emperor? Do you know? Who is emperor? Does anybody know? Who's the emperor that killed Peter and Paul? Who's the emperor?
Was it Nero?
It was Nero. Very good. Now, Nero was a fierce, insane emperor. And we know he persecuted the Christians badly. He burned them. Okay. I mean, he did horrible things. So we know the persecution was great. But if this is written before the temple's destroyed, there are many scholars. R.C. Sproul is one of them, for example, and you know that name. He believes that what we're reading about in Revelation is actually all the things took place in the destruction of Jerusalem. That all the events we're reading about, all the judgments and all the things we read about in Revelation, that they're actually all about the judgment on Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. Anybody ever heard that before?
No.
That's new to most of you, right? Okay, that's one of the four views that we're going to be talking about. Those of you, so if you saw the blurb, if you saw the notes, that's called the preterist view. So the date matters, right? If Revelation's written early, it gives us the possibility that we've been looking at Revelation, most of us, all wrong. Now, I'm not telling you I believe that. All I'm telling you is a lot of good scholars now believe that it was an early writing and that the events already happened. All in the judgment on Jerusalem, except, of course, for what? The return of Jesus. Now, I'm not finished talking about that, so we'll come back. But for some of you, that's like, whoa, that's totally brand new. That's okay, okay? But that's one of the views. So the date does matter. So if somebody says, when was Revelation written? You really have to say, some scholars, most, believe it's written near the end of the first century, in the 90s. That's what most scholars would say. But a lot of scholars believe it's written in the 60s. And if they're right, it changes the whole perspective, probably, of what Revelation is about. So when you read through Revelation, what I'm going to be asking you to do is to say, what if these things are actually not all about what's going to happen someday, but things that already happened 2,000 years ago? Okay? So that'll be new to a lot of you. Okay? Now, I always frustrate my students when I teach Revelation, because usually, and this is especially in Africa, I find, they say, just tell me, teacher, which is right? And I say, I'm not going to. I want you to think. And I want you to hear it. And I'll be honest as we move on what I really do think. But I want you simply to hear them, hear the different views, and make some reasonable conclusions. Okay, so I've spent a lot of time already talking about one of those views. Okay, and any questions so far? You're not supposed to understand that one completely, but the date mattered. Bev, question?
Well, you probably already said this, but I mean, can it be both where, I mean, it's about what maybe it already happened, but it like applies throughout people's lives too? Does it have to be about one set time?
Well, we've only talked about what if all these events took place previously. There are four different views. So hold on and see how there are other ways of looking at what Revelation's about. Okay. Now, the downside, people say, if it was really about what happened 2,000 years ago, then what's my application today, right? People say, well, then what am I supposed to get out of it? How does it, you know, and that's a good question, okay? So yeah, that is a good question, okay? Are we just supposed to gain some spiritual, you know, principles from that? But there's a lot more, okay? I was just talking about the date so far. As we've talked about, you know, the word Revelation, we've talked about, the genres of Revelation, right? Prophecy, epistle, and apocalyptic. And now we've talked about the dates that it could have been written, early or late, okay? And you'll need to think about that for a while. That's why I gave you notes, so that you don't have to be writing all this down, okay? And if you don't have the notes, you can still get them, okay? All right, now, when we interpret Revelation, okay? And this is, of course, the big question, when we want to interpret Revelation, there are some common sense rules, okay? Like, for example, when you read in Revelation 13 that a beast rises out of the sea, okay, everybody knows it's not really a beast. Everybody knows it's a symbol, right, of probably a person, but it could be something else. And everybody knows that when we read that it has horns and crowns and all, everybody knows these things symbolize something, right? I mean, automatically, any intelligent person realizes, oh, these are symbolic, right? Now, the other times, it's not obvious. So when we read something about fire and hail mixed with blood coming from the sky, well, what do you think? Is that symbolic? Or does that actually happen exactly like that? We don't know, right? Or we don't agree, let me say. People don't agree on those as to, is that symbolic? Does it look like that? Or does it really happen precisely like that? A third of the world is destroyed, a fourth of the world is destroyed. What about when we see the numbers 7, 3, 10, 1,000 years? Okay, 144,000. How do you know when those numbers, for example, are symbolic or when they are precise? 42 months, 1,260 days, which is 42 months, which is 3.5 years, which is half of 7. Are those symbolic or are they precise? So some of it's just common sense. And then some of it is like, no, wait a minute. Maybe it really is exactly 3.5 years. Did you know that Nero persecuted Christians for almost exactly 3.5 years to the day? I mean, it's almost precisely, maybe not to the day. So people are not quite sure how to be consistent in their interpretations. Some of it's obvious, common sense. Of course, it's not a beast. The lamb, I know that's Jesus. Okay, everybody knows some of them, we can all agree. But other things, we argue and argue and argue. It's got to be 1,000 years. It's got to be 144,000 people. Okay, and not one less. Okay, how do you know that? Now, I'm not sure I can tell you precisely a rule about that. But the problem is, can we be consistent ourselves? Can any of us be absolutely consistent and say, I know that I am always interpreting all of these figuratively properly or literally properly? Okay, so but just be aware of that, because you've been reading things, you've read the Left Behind series, or you've gone to a church that has taught a particular way, or you've gone to atonement where we almost never talk about this at all, and so on. And so you really wonder, you know, exactly how to interpret these things. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, everybody's good, right? Okay, I'm actually going a little faster than I intended to go, and I really want to do now is to talk about the four views, make sure they're very clear, and then see if there are questions. So there are four views that we look at, the four different views, and we could probably count more than four, okay? But here are the four different ways that Revelation is generally interpreted. The first one is the futurist view. So if you've got the notes in front of you, that's the first one I've got, the futurist view. And this one says that the events that we read in Revelation, they're all going to take place shortly before Jesus returns. Now, I can guarantee you that 95% of you, that's the only way that you've heard Revelation taught. Okay, the futurist view, that what we read in Revelation, pretty much from chapter 4, 5, 6, on to like 18, 19, all these things, they're going to take place shortly before Jesus returns. Right? Okay, now, the question we might ask is, Are we in that time period now? Or are we waiting for that time period now? Okay. Now, most people would say that we're waiting. It may be very soon, but we're waiting for it because maybe you think, well, I'm waiting for the temple to be rebuilt or something like that. Okay, I'm waiting for the Antichrist to appear. Because then we all argue about, you know, the tribulation, the rapture, and all these kinds of things. But the future basically says they're all going to take place in the future. Okay. Now, here's where it gets a little bit more confusing. Within the futurist view, there are a few different other views. Can anybody tell me, this is a hard question, I'll ask Lloyd. No. Can anybody tell me, anybody know what a dispensationalist is?
Does yes. Know
who knows what a dispensationalist is? Is that Sherry?
That's Allison.
Oh, Allison. What's a dispensationalist? Because that's hard to define.
Someone who believes that God operates differently in different dispensations of history, such as the pre-church age, the church age, and that usually dispensationalists believe that there's going to be a 7-year tribulation before there'll be a rapture, then there'll be a 7-year tribulation, then Jesus will return to rule physically on the earth for 1,000 years called the millennium. Mm-hmm. And that's another dispensation, the millennium.
Right, right. Now, what you're saying is correct. Now, what's interesting is there are many futurists who believe in the 7-year tribulation, the rapture, the 1,000-year reign, but they're not dispensationalists. The first thing you said is absolutely correct. The idea of the different periods of time where God acts in a different way, that salvation has different rules and so on. But as time has gone on, dispensationalism's got kind of wishy-washy. You know that, like, for example, John MacArthur is a dispensationalist. But many people don't know that because he also is Reformed. And that doesn't seem possible, but it is. What is particular among dispensationalists is they believe that God has a special plan for the nation of Israel. So all you said is right, Allison, but what really marks a dispensationalist is that they look to the nation of Israel and they say God has his hand on that nation. Mm-hmm. And in 1948, that was a big event when that nation right. was formed and God is working to do this. And the thing is, there may be some truth to that, you know, like that, you know, maybe many Jews will come to faith and all that, but they really believe that God has this, all these fulfilled prophecies from the Old Testament are going to take place in national Israel. And this is dispensationalism. Right. And so they look at Revelation through the eyes of that. And so many of the things we see, they're expecting this is the case of the Jews. These are going to be Jewish people here. These are, you know, and it's a very, so among the futurists, we've got dispensationalists and then we've got non-dispensationalists. I'm not going to try to confuse us so much, say, well, that's dispensational, but sometimes I'm going to have to. Okay. The ones that really have their hearts set on the separation of the Jews, that's going to be a dispensational view. Dispensationalists, though, another mark for them is they're really good about taking the Bible literally, but sometimes they go pretty far. And so they will be the ones mostly that say, if it says 7, it's 7. If it says 3, it's 3. If it says 1,000 years, you can count those days. Okay. They will take almost everything in Revelation as literally as possible. I'd even call it literalistically, which is not a word, okay? But dispensationalists are known for saying, the Bible says it, it means it, exactly as closely as possible. If it says that God is gonna destroy a third of the world, it's exactly a third of the world. Let's look at the nations and see how that can be, and the Euphrates River, and the East, and Russia, and Magog, and that's what they do. Hal Lindsey, the great planet Earth, left behind, dispensational. Okay? And so they're trying to be as literal as possible. So when I talk about futurists, they're not all taking every single detail literally. Not every one of them. Okay? But many of what you have heard comes from the dispensational standpoint. Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye, dispensationalists. Hal Lindsey. He's 90 years old. He's still teaching, dispensationalist. Okay. 4C church, dispensationalist. Okay. So I'm not trying to mock them, but I mean, that's just where they are. Okay. So you can be reformed and be a futurist. That's fine. You can. You're obviously with John MacArthur, you can be reformed and be a dispensationalist, but that's a bit odd. That's a bit odd. And Presbyterian has dispensational history. Okay. Like Donald Gray Barnhouse at 10th Presbyterian, but that's also very strange. Okay. So I'm not dispensational. Okay. And I'm not going to recommend it. Okay. So that's the futurist. Now, so for example, you have your Bibles, I assume. Okay. Mm-hmm. Revelation 13. I'm going to use this example. I'm going to use Revelation 13 for each of the four examples, just to talk about how they'll interpret some of the details in Revelation 13. So this is where we read about the beast.
The first beast.
Now, we've read already about a dragon who is Satan, okay? So the dragon is not mentioned in Revelation 13. We've already read about him in Revelation 12. In Revelation 13, we read about a beast. Okay. Could I get somebody to read the first 10 verses of Revelation 13? Somebody read that? Who'll do that?
I'll do it.
Okay, Dana, thank you.
The dragon stood on the shore of the sea.
Oh, he's there. Okay.
And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. People worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it?" The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise its authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. It was given power to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. And it was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world. Whoever has ears, let them hear. If anyone is to go into captivity they will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword they will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of God's people.
Thank you. Now, we don't have to read the rest of the chapter for the futurist view. Now, this beast has 7 heads, okay? Now, the futurist says 7 heads. Now, that reminds us of the 7 hills of Rome. So this beast must have something to do with Rome. So futurists, especially dispensationalists, say, well, Rome is going to be revived. There's going to be a revived Roman Empire. And so the dispensationalists particularly say, well, when the European Union came together, okay, this was the revived Roman Empire. And so the Left Behind series really does this and says, you know, so out of Rome is going to come the Antichrist, the beast. But in any case, there's going to be some kind of an empire or whatever, and out of that comes a person, a beast, okay? The futurists don't obviously all agree on the details, but the futurist says this beast is going to be a world leader. Okay? He's going to be some kind of a world leader of maybe a world government. That doesn't make it totally clear in this chapter, okay? But he's going to be some powerful world leader, very powerful. The horns, the crowns, the heads, all of that talks about all powerful, okay? And we'll get to those details later. He's going to be very powerful, okay? There are some who have said that he will be the Pope, okay? And you can find that on the internet and all that. Say, oh, he's going to be a Pope because, you know, Rome and so on. So the futurist view, you know, believes that the beast is going to be an individual, a person, okay? And we'll read about the mark of the beast and the number at verse 18, the very end of it, the 666, and what that might mean. But basically, that's the take on the futurist view. Now, let's talk about the historicist view. Now, I'm going over this quickly, but we will do Revelation 13 at a later time. The historicist view, this one I will talk about the least of all because nobody believes it anymore, okay? The reformers taught this view, okay? Martin Luther is given the most credit for this particular view. It's a fascinating one. It's just that nobody holds it anymore, okay? It kind of ran its course. The historicist view says this. It's really interesting. It says that what we read about in Revelation is a picture of events that occur from the time John writes all the way to the end of history. Okay, so everything he's writing is occurring from the beginning of John's writing, right, to the first century, until Jesus returns. And the historicists would actually look at each event and try to interpret it, like, oh, those locusts in Revelation 9, that's the Muslim invasions. Okay, or the Moors or something like that. And they'd actually look at each individual thing. And the futurists and the historicists both look at individual events and try to tie it to something that's going on. And they both try to be chronological. Now, there's a problem when you try to take Revelation chronologically. I'll come back to that in a minute. The historicists, okay, what was going on at Martin Luther's time? Well, he believed that the Pope was the Antichrist, okay? So the beast for Martin Luther was the Antichrist. One reason that the historicist view fell out of sorts is that history continued, okay? And then what happens after that? Well, if the Antichrist, the beast, happens here and he's not destroyed and history continues, the historicist view just didn't make any sense anymore. You may be aware that the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 25, actually does say that the Pope is the Antichrist. It's been edited out since then. But the original 1647 Westminster Confession of Faith does call the Pope the Antichrist. Okay? So the historicist view, I'll only mention here and there, but that's, even though that's one of the four views, you won't find any modern scholar that holds to it, okay, or no serious scholar. So we don't really have to talk about that one much. So even though I've said there are four views, okay, Luther, Calvin to some degree, but it's just, you know, it's just not held anymore, okay? Now, as far as chronology goes, if you try to take Revelation chronologically, you actually run into problem, okay? Let me show you. Okay, got your Bibles open? When you go along in Revelation, okay, and you're trying to follow chronologically, look what happens when you get to the end of chapter 6. When you get to Revelation 6 and you get to verse 12, you see what happens there? He opens the sixth seal. Do you see that in verse 12?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a great earthquake, the sun becomes black, the sky rolls back like a scroll. That's a song, isn't it? And Basically what you have is it appears that you got the final judgment if you read those verses, okay? Well, that's a problem. How can you have the final judgment in chapter 6? Okay, so you have the scroll rolling back and the Lord comes, fall on us, hide us, and you have that in chapter 6. And you have in chapter 11, and chapter 14, you have the same kind of thing, what appears to be the final judgment happening. So the futurist and the historicist view both try to take Revelation very chronologically, and I would say it creates all kinds of problems. If you insist that these events are meant to be read sequentially, it doesn't work very well. I'm giving you a lot, I know that, okay? But we'll consider that even when we look at the futurist view as we go. But the historicist view we're pretty much just rejecting. So the futurist view, you're somewhat familiar with now, okay? The events are gonna take place shortly before Jesus returns. I need to spend a bit of time on the preterist view because that one I've mentioned, but it's kind of new to you. Remember the preterist view says that the events took place within a few years after John wrote because the events are about the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay? So when you read about all the hailstones, hey, those are the rocks coming down on Jerusalem. Okay, all the plagues, all the things, oh, mountains fall on us. It's the people crying out, save us, because they're being attacked. And it's judgment on Israel. It's fascinating. Many of the details line up extraordinarily with what we can actually read in Josephus about the history of what happened when Jerusalem was attacked. There are problems with it. There are some details that don't line up. Okay, but it's very, very interesting. Now, here's what I want you to consider in favor of this preterist view that many of you are probably saying, oh, that's ridiculous. Okay, I mean, I just reject that out of hand. Well, don't reject it yet. Do you remember in the Gospels when Jesus says things like, I tell you the truth, there are some standing here that will not taste death until they see me coming in my kingdom? Mm-hmm. When he says to the chief priests, you know, they say, are you the Messiah? And he says, I am, and you will see, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds. I printed out a bunch of verses for you on page 2 in the handout. The preterist says that those references about Jesus coming refer not actually to his second coming, but refer to the judgment on Jerusalem. When he says, you will see me coming in the clouds, it's symbolic language. You will see judgment in your day on Jerusalem. And if you have trouble buying that, if you look at Old Testament verses that I printed out for you, there are a number of them that talk about God coming on the clouds to judge the nations. And so it's fascinating. And you may struggle with that a little bit, saying, oh, I'm not ready to accept that. And you don't have to accept it. But look at the Old Testament imagery. God rides on the wind. He rides in the clouds. He comes in anger. God always rode on clouds, right? The cloud and the pillar. This is how God expresses himself. It's symbolic language. Could it be that when Jesus says, I'm coming on the clouds, okay, that's what he means? I'm not saying that that's the final coming when the trumpet will sound, but even when he says, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him in Revelation 1:7, is he talking about his actual final coming, or is he talking about the judgment on Jerusalem? If you're a preterist, then you believe that those are statements about his judgment on Jerusalem, and then much of this falls into place. Because you have to admit, all of us have struggled with Jesus saying, I'm coming soon, and many will not perish before they see me. Okay, you will not have gone through all of Israel before the Son of Man comes, and those kinds of statements. You say, how can they be true? Well, the preterist says, let me tell you how they're true. He was talking about when he comes in judgment. So I'm not trying to convince you. I'm just trying to say that's how the preterist looks at it. That's how they interpret many of the times that he says, I'm coming. He says, I'm coming in judgment. Anybody have a question or comment? I might be able to clarify something. So you don't have to agree at all. Everybody's good with that, huh?
I have a bit of a question.
Yeah, man.
Is it possible, you know, it seems like you're doing a lot of reading in with all of these views. Is it possible to sort of juggle the ball so you look at it both ways, in the sense that maybe the fall of Jerusalem was sort of a preview of what's going to happen in a later time?
Oh, very good, man. That very good. Yeah, it would be another course. But if you read, for example, Matthew 24, when the disciples say, tell us about these things, because they say, look at all these stones. And he says, I tell you, not one stone will be left on top of the other. And they say, tell us about these things. When will these things be? And tell us about your coming. They ask two questions. And he mixes them. And so if you look at Matthew 24, most of you, when you read Matthew 24, you think Jesus is only talking about his final return. Read it again and realize some of the time he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and some of the time he's talking about his final return. And there is a parallel between some of the same judgments and the same return. So it's very interesting. I have not completely solved it myself, okay? But that's what the preterist does. So when I read somebody like R.C. Sproul and Jay Adams, a name that you may or may not have heard of, and Kenneth Gentry and some others, I'm thinking, this is really interesting. I don't know if I agree, but it's a very interesting view. Okay, so I just want you to be aware of it. Okay, there's a book by R.C. Sproul called The Last Days According to Jesus. That you could look at. It's not very difficult to get through. And it's just, it talks about that among other things. So, just put that aside. That's just one of the views. I'm trying to respect our time. So we'll just mention that view. And I want to talk about the fourth view. And this one, I think you'll find very interesting. And it's called the idealist view. Okay, the preterist view, by the way, I talked about the Romans 13. The preterist view says, oh, that the beast is Nero. The beast is Nero. There's no question about it. In fact, the 666, I'm going to show you how that can be Nero's name. Okay, when we get to Revelation 13, the 666, nobody definitely knows how to interpret it, even though some people are sure that they're just sure they know. But I can show you how it has been definitely shown how that is, that's Nero's name, the 666. Okay. And so the preterists say, see, we've got it. We can prove to you that this is all about what happened 2,000 years ago. Okay. Now, the last one's the idealist view. I think you'll find this one interesting. And usually, to be honest, when I teach this, this is the view that my students usually grab onto. Okay, but I'm not going to try to convince you that you do, okay, because I like it, but I'll explain. The idealist view says this: when we look at Revelation, we understand that they're pictures, they're symbols, they're spiritual warfare, but they're not meant to be chronological. What they're meant to be are cycles of things that are happening throughout history. So it sounds like they're stark, but they're repeated. So they're repeated fulfillments of things. So for example, when there's a plague of disease, there are many plagues, there are many diseases. There are many, many times God sends disease. Many times there's gonna be plagues. Many times this kind of thing is gonna happen on the earth. And what we see is not only are they repeated fulfillments, but as time goes on, they become greater and greater and greater until Jesus returns. Okay, so the idealist says, we're not looking for one fulfillment. We're expecting many fulfillments of these different trumpets, and bowls and you know the different things that we see. Okay, we're the seals, the trumpets, the bowls. There are different fulfillments of them. We're not looking. We're not taking our newspaper and saying, "There it is. That particular one is being fulfilled. Come, Lord Jesus, tomorrow." We're saying, "Here it is again." Okay, Revelation is being fulfilled here again, but it may yet happen greater again in the future. So idealist says, I don't know when Jesus is coming, but I see these things being fulfilled constantly throughout history. That's what's called the idealist view. Now, some people say, that's a cop-out, you know, because it's just so easy. It's easy and it's hard because you're looking at the principles, the different things, and you're saying, yeah, you know what? How many beasts would there be then? There could be many. Okay? By definition, the beast would be anyone or anything that opposes Christ and the church. Anyone that gets up and tries to kill the church. Well, that has happened many times in history. Okay? Now, I want you to notice, and we didn't read the entire chapter, okay? There's a second beast in Revelation 13. You have the dragon, you have the first beast, and then you have a second beast that tries to get everybody to worship the first beast, okay? So you've got a dragon, okay? You have the second beast, you have a third beast, three persons. Does that remind you of anything?
Trinity.
Yeah, it's a false trinity. It's an evil trinity. And so the idealist says, aha, this is a picture of Satan trying to imitate God. And you even have the beast looks like he had been slain. Okay, so you have the beast trying to imitate Jesus because he looks like he had been slain, but he rose up again. And so you have an imitation of the trinity, trying to lure people away into false worship of a false God. And so you see the idealist just can go to town on this and say, oh, that could happen here, it can happen here, it can happen here. You know, it's not just one person. Now the idealist says, however, there may still rise up a man of lawlessness that we read about in 2 Thessalonians, that will be the ultimate fulfillment of this beast. But there have been and will be many beasts. Okay, so that's what the idealist view looks like. Now, here's what happens. We can combine views, okay? We can combine like the futurist and the idealist view to some degree. We can say, I realize that, okay, maybe you don't like the preterist view. Say, I just reject that. Don't reject it straight out. Let me say, okay, I don't think that's the right one. And we've already rejected the historicist view because we say that's just not possible. We can't tie one event, one passage to one event. And Pope Leo was not the beast, okay? So we reject the historicist view. So the futurist and the idealist, what we could say is many of these events have not yet happened, but many of them have, and they continue to happen. And we expect many of these things to occur, but not in a very literal way. Okay, so as we read these, we're going to be looking to say, well, how are they, how have they been interpreted, or how could they be interpreted? So yeah, to be blunt, I'll be favoring the idealist view, but my assumption will be that these things will be mostly future. But we can also talk about how things in history have fulfilled some of these passages as well. Who's the question? Anybody? Have I lost anybody entirely? A few people just join us. Hi, Mary.
Am I muted or not?
I hear you, Lloyd.
Okay. I couldn't tell that the button was saying one thing or the other. It didn't seem to act. Anyway, back in the third view, mm-hmm. where it said that Jesus says, and some of you are going to live to see me coming in my glory.
Yes.
Right after that is the transfiguration.
That's true.
And so some people would say, oh, okay, that's what that was about.
That's a common interpretation of what he meant when he said that. But the thing is, he says that kind of thing in several other places.
A few other places.
So that's right. That's the way that's generally been interpreted, because we don't know what else to do with that. So he may be what he meant there to the apostles.
Okay, and then another one is, I suppose we'll get to 666, but
we will.
Six is a kind of a symbol of incomplete, not perfect,
right?
Counterfeit.
Right. Yeah.
And so, a counterfeit that is such to deceive people.
Yeah. Yeah. Both the futurist and the idealist, one of their interpretations of 666 is simply less than perfection. You know, like it's the number of a man. And so one of the possibilities, like the false trinity that I just was talking about, well, three right. sixes, right? 666. Yeah. It's a false trinity. That's just one of the many possibilities. But the number of a man, since seven is perfect, you know, the number of a man, the sixth day he was created. I mean, there's so many different things you can do with that. Okay. Right. It's the preterist that is so sure. Oh, it's Nero. Let me show you how I can calculate his name from the letters. Okay. But there are, but other people's names have been Ronald Wilson Reagan, right? There are six letters in each of his. And some people did that. I mean, it's crazy.
What are you doing?
Chan's trying to mute.
Anyway, any other questions?
I have a question. If Revelation is written about events that happened during the time of Nero,
yeah,
then why is the language so obfuscated in symbolism? I mean, why wouldn't they say, well, you Christian, you know, I mean, when I read through the book of Revelation, I see that it's a kind of a stand fast Christian, but the victory has been won. To me, that's what I see in the total book. Mm-hmm. But why all the symbolism?
That's a good question. I think they would say, you know, it's still 5 or 6 years away from occurring. And so he's not spelling out specifically what's going to happen, but just warning them that these things are going to take place. But Shilam, even the 666 for Nero's name is hidden, so that only, and I'll show you how, that only the Jews would recognize that that refers to Nero. I mean, the other question is, and this goes both directions, the preterist, if these things happened 2,000 years ago, how does that help us, right? How does that help us today? But for the futurist, if he's writing to seven churches and saying, let me encourage you, seven churches, in thousands of years from now, these things are going to happen. How is that an encouragement? And that's often been the criticism. How can John be writing about things that aren't going to occur until just before the return of Christ, and how in any way can that be an encouragement to the seven churches? We can probably find a reason, right? Well, someday Jesus is going to triumph. You all may die, but someday Jesus is going to triumph. That's an answer. It may not satisfy. Yeah, both extremes, right? If it's going immediately going to happen, then the relevance for us is much harder to grasp. And if it's not going to happen too much later, the relevance for them is hard to grasp. But any prophecy has that problem, right? As how is it relevant to the people immediately, or how is it relevant to us much later? But your original question, it is hidden. And I think the preterist would say, because they are under persecution, they would understand it because they know their scriptures. They would understand what's happening. But the others that read it would not realize what's about to take place. So it's hidden for the world to see, but for all who know scripture, they would recognize the symbols and what they represent, and they would know what's about to take place. And they can escape Jerusalem. They can escape and be saved. So that's the best answer I can give, I think. Okay. Anybody else? Hi, Mike.
So this is not so much a question as maybe a request for another time, because you can't do it in this short a time. But since the dispensationalist point of view has such a significant impact on the review, on the understanding of this book, and in popular culture, mm-hmm. it's certainly an exciting interpretation.
Oh yes.
Can maybe in one of these sessions you spend some time talking about what underlies that viewpoint and why in the covenant theology we would not be sympathetic to that way of looking at things, I guess.
Yeah, I can try. I can try. Remind me of that. I won't do that right now. The last thing I want to do now, and then we do need to stop, is just looking at history overall. You know, I was trying to figure out, like, early church, it's very hard to figure out what view they held about Revelation. They very quickly moved to allegories, and you know, so they had some kind of a futuristic view, but it's very hard to be sure. Then we have the Middle Ages, and we have the historicist view. The futuristic view seemed to get more popular in response to the reformers, and then it got really popular in the 19th century with dispensationalism in particular. So the preterist view was also around that same time. The idealist view, the last one, that's mostly been just the last couple of centuries as well. It's really hard to figure out what has been the prevailing view over history. Okay, the dispensational view, you might be aware, is fairly new in church history anyway. Okay, the whole dispensational view, the Darby, Schofield, all that, I mean, all that just comes out in the 19th century anyway. So that whole thing is kind of new. But the idea of seeing it as future has been around for a few hundred years. The idea that all these things are going to take place much, much later. So it's very hard to I was trying to figure out a plan of, like, okay, so that's when this interpretation came in, that's when this interpretation came in. And it was really hard to do it. The main thing was, I knew when the historicist view became really popular, and then we say that the Catholic Church responded and said, no, it's all about the future. And so we know that's when the futuristic view became very popular, is in response to the reformers. And that's about all I can be sure of about that. Okay, for next week, I hope you all will join us again. I'll send out for all of you that emailed me and asked me for the handout, I'll send out the next one. If you did not get one and need it, you just need to email me, so I have your email address, and I'll send you the next bunch of notes. Read as much of Revelation as you can. I'm going to try to get to chapter 5 or something like that. I'm going to be going over the letters to the churches specifically pretty quickly, Revelation 2 and 3. I'll be going over those fairly quickly. So I'll be anxious to get into Revelation 4, 5, and 6. Okay, not Revelations, but Revelation, okay? So I definitely want to get as far as chapter 6 next week, if I can. Okay, so definitely read that far. But if you can read the entire book, that would be good. So, any last question or anything? Then I will pray. And
I have a quick question.
Yeah, Gabor.
Sorry. In the idealist view, is, you know, they talk about.
Bev, yeah.
Are there more than me talking?
Yeah, Bev, go ahead.
In the idealist view, where they talk about the multiple fulfillments, are there any sub views of that people think that this is more, happens more like on an individual basis, and that Jesus's big return and opening of the seals really happens more individually when we stand before God, or do they all believe in Jesus will have a final return?
All four views believe in the final return of Jesus. There's a small subset of the preterist view that's a heresy that believes that
preterist.
His return is even in the past. And that's a heresy. So all four views believe that his final return is yet to come. Okay, so all four views still say, no matter what we believe, we still wait for his final return at the end. So that's a simple answer. Okay, Gabor?
Thank you.
Can you, you're still muted, Gabor. Okay, right. Go ahead.
The letters to the churches and the rest of Revelation.
Yeah.
What's wrong about saying that the letters to the churches are both specific warnings to specific churches and general warnings to the rest of Christianity, and the rest of Revelation is, hey, here are the bad things that are to come. Not necessarily bad things. The events that are to come to prepare.
Well, that much I will cover about the churches. I will say that the futurist believes that these are, you know, like in other words, are they symbolic or are they specific situations? How are we supposed to read? The fact that there are seven churches is an interesting thing. Okay, and what are we supposed to take away about the fact that these seven, why these seven, you know, look at where they're located and all that. That much I'll do. Okay, and so I will cover that next week. I just won't go into all the specifics about what's the white stone of Pergamum and all that. I won't do that. Okay. Okay, anything else? Okay.